Last week, the White House declassified parts of a National Intelligence Estimate report after details became public through media leaks. Among its conclusions, the war in Iraq has made the threat of terrorism worse. We've been speaking with experts in the field for their reaction to the report. So far, we've talked with an international terrorism expert and a professor who does research on suicide bombers. Joining us today is Richard Clark. He served as an advisor on intelligence and counterterrorism to four presidents: Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and President George W. Bush. When he retired nearly 4 years ago, he was head of counterterrorism for the National Security Council. If you have questions for Richard Clark about terrorism, national security, or what the administration should do now, give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. Richard Clark, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, Michelle, it's good to be with you again.
First, let me get your reaction to the intelligence estimate. Do you think it's an accurate assessment of where things stand in the war on terror? And was there anything in it that you found particularly surprising or helpful?
Well, I think you can quibble as you can with any national intelligence estimate. You can quibble with this or that sentence. But what people took away from it and what the news media concentrated on was the conclusion that by being in Iraq, we have made the war on terrorism harder. Well, that seems to me a blinding flash of the obvious and something that a lot of us said even before we invaded.
So is the report, does it do anything to advance public discussion, or do you credit that its release was in effect a political gesture?
Well, I don't know that it was a political gesture. I think it was written by intelligence agency professionals. Whoever leaked it 6 months after it was approved might have done so for political reasons. But I think it's a rather obvious fact. The polling that's been done since the story broke, however, is fascinating because it shows a 14-point swing among Americans when asked, do you think by being in Iraq we have made the war on terrorism better or worse? And now it's about 46-47% of the American people say they think it's made it worse. And, of course, it has.
Now, of course, the NIE is being used by political leaders of all sides to bolster their existing positions on the Iraq war. You wrote an op-ed in last Sunday's New York Times about a similar phenomenon related to 9/11. If you would just tell us about the piece that you wrote for those who didn't have a chance to see it, and they can look it up on our website later if they'd care to. But tell us what you had to say.
What I said was Bill Clinton took after Chris Wallace on Fox Sunday. And it wasn't so much for what Chris Wallace had done, but for the fact that there has been, in the last month or so, this attempt to reopen the conclusions of the 9/11 Commission and rewrite history and say it was all Bill Clinton's fault, which is ridiculous. And the 9/11 Commission certainly didn't conclude that. So Clinton was perfectly fine and right and justified in an angry response to that distortion of the record. But what happened after that, Michelle, was this incredible back and forth between Condi Rice and all of the blogs and all of the talk shows and people focusing on events of 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 years ago. To win this war on terrorism, if you want to call it that, the struggle against Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, we can't be wasting our time and energy pointing fingers at each other in this country, using the war on terrorism as a political device to get reelected, as a political weapon to divide the United States people into warring camps. We have to be united, not worried about partisan politics, and try to find the best answers about how to deal with this issue.
Do you feel that that's actually happening behind the scenes? Or that this, I mean, it could be that just this is the public sort of discussion that needs to happen for political purposes, but behind the scenes, is there in fact good, important, rational conversation going on with the right people about how to move forward?
No, not that I can detect. I think what the president and Karl Rove have done going back several years now, this election is just the latest, is that they've used the tragic events of September 11th and the threat posed by al-Qaeda as a way of saying, vote for the Republicans, we're better on terrorism, the Democrats are soft on terrorism. It's repulsive that the president and his party machinery would try to use the deaths of 3,000 Americans on September 11th as a way of getting their party elected and casting aspersions on other people in the United States and saying that they're soft on terrorism. I think it's outrageous.
You, in your previous book, and also in your op-ed, you point out that, you know, mistakes have been made in more than one administration, that the Clinton administration made mistakes in failing to take advantage of the opportunities that they could have taken to address al-Qaeda early on. And you say that, and of course, you know, you've discussed what you think the President Bush's sort of difficulties are. Are you more disturbed by one player than the other?
Well, I don't think that's a useful or productive question, because I think it gets us right back to this thing I'm trying to have the country avoid and get over, which is finger-pointing about what happened in the past in the war on terrorism. The 9/11 Commission did a really good job. It spent millions of dollars. It had thousands of hours of interrogations and hearings. It's got a really well-written report that anyone can read and understand. And while I don't agree 100% with what it says, I agree with 98% of what it says, and I think everyone involved feels that way. And that's the history. Let's not try to rewrite it. Let's go forward, and go forward together as a country.
I take your point, and I respect what you have to say, but there is an issue that's in the news right now, and I would just like to get your response to it if I can, and then we'll move on. But in Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial, he writes about a meeting on July of 2001 between then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, then CIA Director George Tenet, and George Tenet's counterterrorism chief, Kofor Black. There's been controversy about whether the meeting happened at all or whether Dr. Rice just kind of blew off the CIA folks in their information, that she just didn't take it seriously. Does that matter? Do things like that matter?
I don't think they really matter anymore. I mean, they may matter if someday Dr. Rice decides to run for Senate in California or something and people want to dredge this up. Yes, the meeting took place. I was in it. I arranged it. I think she took it seriously. She didn't do anything as a result, but I think she took it seriously. But that was then. We have some serious problems now. The war in Iraq is a disaster. It's going from bad to worse. We do not have a dialogue in this country about how we're going to get out of it. The dialogue is in terms of bumper stickers, you know, stay the course. On the right wing side, on the left wing side, you know, something equally nonsensical, bumper sticker. We need a sophisticated national dialogue about how we're going to get out of this problem that we got into.
Let's go to Oakland, California, and Max. Max, what's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am curious to know how Mr. Clark might define victory in the war on terror. We constantly hear the president talking about the United States and civilized cultures being ultimately victorious in this fight, but I cannot see a clear path to victory, and I'm wondering if Mr. Clark has any thoughts on how we actually define what victory is?
Well, it's a great question, and I think we need a dialogue on that, but let me offer my suggestion. There have been many terrorist groups in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years that are no longer around as terrorist groups. There was the Red Army Brigade in Germany, similar groups in Japan and Italy. There was the Provisional IRA in Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom. And other such groups around the world, and they have largely ceased to exist, or they have become such a joke and a rump organization that they really pose no threat anymore. That's what I'd like to see happen to al-Qaeda and similar related groups, and I think that can be achieved over many years if we do it intelligently. What we've done in the last 5 or 6 years, I think, only helps al-Qaeda, and that was the NIE's conclusion.
Max, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
I have an email from a listener in Cleveland, Ohio. His name is Rob, and he asks, what economic initiatives will have the best chance of stemming the tide of recruits for terror organization and eventually make such organizations wither and die?
Well, I think the economic issue is an interesting one because there are those who say that poverty breeds terrorism. And yet, if we look at the 9/11 hijackers, they were all upper middle class for the most part. There are areas of the world, and parts of Pakistan are certainly among them, where poverty and lack of educational opportunity, aside from the madrasas that teach hate, do contribute to terrorism. But fundamentally, terrorism is, or at least the jihadi terrorism, is not an economically motivated or driven issue. It's ideological, it's religious, but not an issue that we can address so much through economics.
I'm sorry, I'm having some difficulty hearing Richard Clark.
I'm still here.
Okay. And had you finished your answer? I'm sorry, I was having difficulty hearing you.
No,
okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, then let me go to a caller in Stockton, California. Ken, what's your question?
My question is this. Is there a way for us to constructively sort of disengage or walk away from this war on terror without causing the increase in terrorism that we keep hearing about?
Well, I don't think we can walk away from it. I think if we do nothing, it's only going to get worse. We do have to engage it. The problem is that we've chosen the last several years to engage it in a way that's counterproductive and that actually strengthens it. There are probably more fundamentalist Islamic terrorists now than there were on September 11th, and probably more people in the Islamic world that support them than there were on September 11th. But walking away, just disengaging, is not an option.
Is it really a matter of fixing the electricity and the water and so forth? Would that have any effect at all? Or
are you talking about Iraq?
Yes.
No, I think that would have a minor effect. It's probably too late. If we had fixed the water and the electricity, if we'd done a number of things quickly after going in, there are those who believe that we could have avoided the situation we're in now. I'm not one of them. But there are people who I respect who know a lot more about Iraq than I do who say that we could have done this well, and it could have worked, but that time, that opportunity, that window to do that has passed. I think now what we have to do is figure out a way of handing over the problem to the Iraqis and finding a way for the United States to minimize our military presence over the course of the next 12 to 18 months.
Thank you very much.
Ken, thank you for your call. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mr. Clark, I have another email question for you from John Brand, and he asks, why not the India solution in Iraq? Since a division of Iraq into three parts seems inevitable, how about using the British approach in India and try and oversee the division and set it up so that the Shiites would be required to share a portion of their oil revenue?
Well, Senator Biden on the Foreign Relations Committee, Les Gelb from the Council on Foreign Relations, both people I respect enormously, have suggested something like this. There are real problems with implementation, I think. First of all, the partition of India and Pakistan was a terribly bloody and brutal partition. It wasn't smooth at all. And it created a situation that goes on to this day of hatred and animosity, and frequently war scares between the two countries. The trouble in Baghdad is you've got Shia and Sunni living right next to each other, in some cases in mixed neighborhoods, although that's increasingly less true. But it's going to be very hard, I think, to find a way that everyone would be happy with of dividing the country up. And as the question suggests, there's a problem with the Sunnis because they wouldn't have any land that has any oil in it. And they would have to buy faith in a proposal that they would somehow get paid anyway from the country's oil wealth. And they probably wouldn't believe that they'd get paid.
We're down to our last couple of minutes, Mr. Cox. I just want to ask, are there, you've called for, rational discourse going forward involving all the important sort of political actors, sort of walking back from kind of the extreme partisanship that you see has taken over. The public doesn't really have much ability to participate in that. But if there were immediate first steps that you would like to see taken to advance the kind of discourse you'd like to see on what to do going forward, what would those be?
No, I think it only continues to be the case that people use the bloody shirt, use terrorism as a hobgoblin, because it works in partisan political terms. It gets people elected. If it stops getting people elected, then they'll stop using it. So I think one thing that the public can do is if you see a candidate in your district who is using this argument that terrorism is best done by one party and the other party is soft on terrorism, reject it. Reject the candidate who says that.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on another book. I have a novel coming out in January that talks about the future 5 or 6 years from now when technology accelerates and how those new technologies that are going to be here 5 or 6 years from now will really change the nature of our society, including politically and sociologically.
A novel.
A novel, yeah. It's my second novel, and sometimes you can tell more truth through fiction.
Have you found that to be the case? I mean, do you feel that people are, that you're better able to kind of impart a message through your fiction?
I think it's an easier pill to swallow, to read a thriller. My first one is called Scorpion's Gate. The next one's called Breakpoint. And they're both in the format of a thriller, but I think they also, they teach you a little something along the way about what the near future is going to look like.
Okay. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Richard Clark was head of counterterrorism at the National Security Council for President Bush. He's also the author of Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. He spoke with us from his office in Arlington, Virginia. You can read his op-ed in the New York Times. There's a link at the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington.